is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. America is full. No vacancies. That's the message President Trump sent to immigrants last Friday when speaking at the U.S.-Mexico border in Calexico, California.
So as I say, and this is our new statement, the system is full. Can't take you anymore. Whether it's asylum, whether it's anything you want, it's illegal immigration, can't take you anymore.
Still, thousands of immigrants, migrants arriving at the border daily, a flow that the country is ill-prepared to manage. In a recent cover story for The Atlantic, senior editor David Frum argues that the political impasse over immigration has led to the radicalization of our politics and the rise of authoritarian ideas. He challenges the country to address the question at the heart of the immigration debate. How many people should we let into America? And who should those people be? David Frum's article for The Atlantic is called If Liberals Won't Enforce Borders, Fascists Will. David Frum is here. It's great to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much, Todd.
You drew some fire for that article, and we're going to get into why. But it's really sparked a discussion. And later in the hour, I want to say we're going to be joined by writer and journalist Jose Antonio Vargas, who's going to challenge some of the arguments that you made. And we're going to have a real discussion about it, because the binary discussion over immigration gone to the polls is some of what I think you're hoping to remedy here. So let's go to the title. If liberals won't enforce the borders, the fascists will. What did you mean by that?
Well, thank you for saying the article drew fire. At 7,000 words, you're either igniting a fire or dropping a very wet blanket atop the fire. So better a little spark. The title you cite is a phrase in the article, and it's the title of the online edition. The print edition has a little more anodyne a title. But I have been reporting on the immigration issue since the early 1990s, writing about it for a long time. And what I have been worried about for a long time, and it has come to pass in the past decade, is if the flow of immigration becomes too much, you provoke reactions. That is a predictable thing. And you give rise to reactionary politics. And we have seen that in the European Union. We have seen what has happened since Angela Merkel opened the borders of Germany in the summer of 2015 to 1.2 million refugees from all over the world, most ostensibly from Syria, but in fact from everywhere. That set in motion the collapse of liberal government in Poland. And it was a crucial step on the way to the British vote to leave the European Union, which I regard as a big mistake. Of course, immigration is a proximate cause of the rise of Donald Trump. Not the only cause, but the nearest cause. So I have been warning for a long time that there are things that people just want done. They want crime prevented. Back in the 60s, we told people that only a racist would be concerned about crime. In the 1930s, they were concerned about unemployment. At that time, their establishment figures said only the communists cared about unemployment. The whole point to responsible politics is to identify, to listen to the voters about what are the important issues, and then to provide responsible solutions. Last thing, and you said this at the very beginning, the Trump presidency has radicalized this debate to a point where people do think of this as a binary choice. Come one, come all, or the country is full. The United States and every developed country needs some immigration. We don't replace ourselves. Our birth rates are below the number to keep even the population stable. And of course, in a mobile world, companies, firms, individuals want to attract talent, and people marry outside their national boundaries. So there's going to be movement. So it's a question of how much. And that is a question that Americans have tended in recent years to think about in polemical rather than responsible ways.
Well, if the immigration debate is the proximate cause of the rise of Donald Trump, in your view, let's talk about the proximal moment of immigration with Donald Trump. Because after the purge of last week, the removal of the Homeland Security Secretary and several other officials, the president not only has said in his own words that he wants to get tougher, the administration has signaled a possible return to some of the policies like child family separation, even if it's rounded around the edges to avoid the courts, other policies as well. Definitely a signal from the president that he wants to get even more hard line. Is this the sort of quote unquote fascist response that you're talking about, these types of policies in the servicing of frustration and anger for the base?
Right. Well, this is what I worry about enormously, because President Trump's policies not only won't work, they've already failed. The flow of Central American border crossers slowed in 2016 and 2017 and has been accelerating in 2018 and 2019 on his watch. And it looks like it's going to be 100,000 people in the past, in the month of March, which is a rate of unauthorized border crossing faster than the peak of the illegal immigration movements of the 1990s. Now, President Trump isn't trying to solve this problem. He doesn't care, and he has no idea. He's using this problem as the basis of his reelection campaign. So if you want to stop him, you have to address this, because taking in 100,000 Central American border crossers who are claiming asylum but are not going to get it and who are not authentic asylum seekers, that is a formula for disaster. Let me talk specifically about Central America. The rate of Central America is a disorderly and violent place, but American law does not give you a right of asylum because your place of origin is disorderly and violent. Not only that, the amount of violence in Central America has dropped precipitately. It's down by about 75% since the peak year of 2013. And yet the border crossings are up and up and up, because Central Americans, being rational people like us, being motivated to better their lives like anybody else, immigrants are the same as everybody else. They see that there is a new path to get into the United States. So, of course, they're taking it. And the American response should be, instead of blaming people or threatening violence against them, to say, look, we can see what's happening here. This is an abuse of the asylum system. This asylum system needs to be fixed. A clear message needs to be sent. You are not going to be able to enter the United States this way, and you need to find a way to deter people from coming in the first place. And you need to do it while keeping sight of the humanity of people, that in a way they are doing what you would do in their shoes, but we are doing what they would do if they were in our shoes.
So this moment at the border, and the president calls it a crisis with asylum seekers, a broken system, seems to occlude the much larger issue of who should we have in this country? What can the economy tolerate? The benefits that immigration bring to our economy? And you talk about those in the article. We're going to get to those. Let's stick for a second to the proximal case, because the New York Times last night reported from the border, basically saying our reporting from the border is that the U.S. immigration system is now officially broken. Yes. The breaking point that we've warned about for all these many years of avoiding comprehensive reform has arrived. Overwhelmed border crossing, abuse of the asylum system, unable to provide humanitarian care to people who arrive, and hundreds of thousands of people in judicial backlog.
And when you say judicial backlog, that means they've been released into the country illegally and are going to stay here forever. When you come as an asylum seeker, the first step is you're interviewed to assess whether you have a credible fear. It doesn't have to be true. It just, you know, is it plausible? About three quarters of all the people present themselves pass the credible fear interview and are then taken into the asylum system. And that means these days they're released into the country. In the end, fewer than 20% will be granted asylum. And from Central America, it's probably fewer than 10% will be granted asylum. So what happens to the gap between the three quarters who get in and the less than one-tenth who will ultimately be told, yes, you can stay? And the answer is they vanish. They become illegal immigrants. And they know this. That's why they come. And again, it's not a moral failing on their part. They're behaving rationally. But we are creating a situation in which there are going to be more than a million unauthorized border crossers in the United States, on top of the 1.2 million people who come legally to the United States.
It's stressing
the system, and it's stressing the political system and enabling the rise of authoritarian forces in this country and in Europe.
But I want to make sure we pull away then from the issue of the crisis in asylum and people using that system to get into the country quite rationally, to the prospective case. Who should we be asking to come here? Who should we be enabling to come here? And what's best for our economy and our culture?
Well, the United States right now takes legally about 1.2 million people a year. That's a number that was set in the year 1990, and it was arrived at quite accidentally. And it's very unlikely that if the number was right in 1990, it remains the right number all these years later. About almost 70% of those people are here because they are related to somebody who got here earlier. They are not being chosen by the United States with any reference to the needs of the United States. That basically, immigrant one comes in, settles, becomes a citizen, sponsors relatives. They come in, sponsor their relatives. Again, they are behaving rationally from their point of view, but they're not meeting any American requirements. So my proposal in the article is we revisit the immigration choices of 1990, and I think that it makes more sense to go back to the choices of the 1980s, when the United States took about 550,000 legal immigrants a year. that is enough to more than enough to stabilize the population. Even at 550, we'll have a growing population. And that we should rebalance it from 70-30 relatives to people who come for economic reasons to the other way around, 30% relatives, 70% people come economic. And when I say relatives, by the way, I don't mean spouses. Spouses enter without limit. You marry someone outside the United States, of course you want to bring them with you, or that you may want to follow them to where they live. And the last question is, how do we enforce this? Because right now the United States has a very militarized border. We talk about immigration as a matter of border security. But I think the place you need to enforce immigration is at the workplace. Hmm. And that the wall and the drones and the AVs and all the guns, that's a way of protecting employers from the duty to check when you hire somebody. Are they legally authorized? That's not how we enforce laws against child labor. That's not how we enforce laws against wage theft. We enforce them at the workplace. That's how immigration should be enforced, too.
That's David Frum of The Atlantic. Today's conversation tackles a big question. Who belongs in America? We're going to be adding another voice to this conversation in just a little bit, and we're adding your voice as well. Kansas Patriot wrote on our website, the USA is the melting pot of the world, and we are much better as a result. I enjoy the cultures, foods, and experiences that immigrants bring to our country. International borders are nothing more than lines drawn on a map. Speaking with David Frum of The Atlantic, his views on immigration policy in America. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stick with us. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're discussing immigration with David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic. We'd love to hear from you as well. Who does belong in America? What piece of the immigration debate do you think folks get wrong? Do you agree with President Trump that our first priority should be to look after those who are here and do whatever we can to deter more people from trying to cross the border? Comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A, the email address, 1A@WAMU.org. We got this comment on our website. We have too much unoccupied land to be full, as the president says, but we may well be at the limit for how much change we as a society can tolerate. Too much, too fast. That's inherently destabilizing. It takes time for immigrants to assimilate and for the host society to adjust. David Frum, here's the policy conundrum along those lines that you describe in your article. It goes like this: too little immigration and you freeze your country out of the modern world. Too much or the wrong kind and you overstress your social insurance system and possibly upend your democracy. Choose well and you build a stronger, richer country for both newcomers and the long settled. Choose badly and you aggravate inequality and inflame the intergroup hostility.
Yes. As again, it's not all or nothing. It's not yes or no. I'm a naturalized citizen myself. I was born in Canada, was naturalized in the United States in 2007. And I come from a long line of migrants. Three of my four grandparents were born subjects of Tsar Nicholas II. And they made it across the ocean and in the nick of time, too. But you have to think carefully. And you also have to think about the kind of society we're building. Let me give you a very practical problem that we face as a result of past choices. There are about 11 million people illegally present in the United States. The peak decade for illegal immigration was the 1990s. We continue to have, the 2010s may end up being a new peak, but the 1990s were our last peak. The majority of those 11 million people have been here for more than a decade, and given that the 1990s were the peak, probably the typical illegal immigrant at this point is a person in his or her 40s. What happens when they turn 65? They're not going home, but they're not entitled to Medicare or Social Security. Do you just ignore them? Or do you very suddenly, at the last minute, legalize them and bring them into the social insurance system? What does that do to the economics of Medicare?
And your fear, as articulated in the article, is that you can wind up with an underclass. Because with those millions of people who are not entitled to public benefits, Social Security and Medicare, they remain. We use this cliche on the fringes, but they remain without access to the social safety net.
We have that now. In 1970, only about 3% of the people inside the borders of the United States were not U.S. citizens. Everybody, virtually everybody, could vote, serve on a jury, was protected by the full range of law. Now, in the immigration magnet states, New York, California, Florida, places like that, 10% or more than 10% are non-citizens. In some cities and states in California, counties in California, you've got groups of 20 and 30 people who are, occupy a variety of subordinated legal statuses. So a key reason that you want to have less immigration is so you can absorb, not just culturally, because immigrants learn the language and they do more or less well depending on what they bring with them in terms of human capital, making it into the American economic system, but to make Americans out of them. And that means, by the way, protecting them against a society that can often be quite rapacious. I don't think it's because of immigration, for example, that the United States has become a more unequal society so dramatically. But had it remained the equal society that it was, it would not have tolerated the level of illegal immigration and the subordination of people that comes as a result.
Now, David, from the policies that you're talking about would require bipartisan buy-in, and, mm-hmm. and you have, it's in the title of your article, you have this challenge to liberals. If you don't get serious about the border, the demagogues and the fascists in that online title will do it for you. But we had consensus or something close to it, at least in the Senate in 2013, when the so-called Gang of Eight, four Republicans, four Democrats, came together on immigration reform in the Senate. Let me give you this. This is South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham on the floor at the time.
To the American people, you've got to be frustrated by your Congress not being able to do the hard things, and sometimes even the simple things. This should give you a little bit of hope that for the first time since 2007, the United States Senate, in a bipartisan fashion, is about to pass legislation on an important topic that's emotionally tough but needs to be dealt with.
Broad immigration reform. 68 votes in the Senate. 14 Republicans were for it. I think today, if that bill were to come up, Lindsey Graham would vote against it. He's up for re-election in South Carolina. And I think that some of your critics might say, hey, look, from liberals were at the table. They were for enforcing the border. They did vote for consensus approach. They have voted for increased border security time after time after time as an inducement to get Republicans to the table. But now this argument has veered into the politics of dehumanization and racism. And until that ends, appeasement is not a smart strategy.
You have to read the fine print of what was agreed in 2007 and 2013. So those so-called comprehensive agreements, and there are many different varieties of them, always had two elements in common. The first was a big increase in total numbers. They were fusions of immigration advocacy plus employer interests. So there is a program of legalization of the people who are here illegally, plus big increases in numbers in every category because we wouldn't make choices. And so the answer is, rather than do trade-offs, rather than say have less family immigration, we'll keep the family immigration we have and then add a big new tranche of employer-sponsored immigration on top. And it was on that question of total numbers that those agreements foundered. And here's why this total numbers question is so important. People who argue against me make the very one of the best arguments against me, which is say, if you look, compare the flow of legal immigration to the population of the country today and compare it to 1900, although it feels like we're getting a lot of immigration, actually relative to the existing population in the United States, we're getting a lot more in 1900 than we are now. And that's true. But the difference between now and 1900 was in 1900, Americans were also having a lot of children. And so even when you had very big flows, actually, the percentage of foreign-born people in the population declined. There are fewer foreign-born people in the population in 1910 than 1890, despite the huge influx. Now, because Americans have so few children, smaller flows of immigration are reshaping the country faster. And we are about, in the year 2027, on our trajectory to pass the all-time peak for foreign-born in the population and then keep rising forever.
Ryan Eller is on Twitter and wants you to answer for this, David Frum. During Southern segregation, the segregationists argued that integration, in other words, more mixing and more people of color, would cause anxiety and political tumult and destabilization. Today, David Frum argues that immigrants are to blame for today's anxiety and political tumult and destabilization, calls for hate group solutions.
I had a wonderful professor of history I studied with, who used to say, history never repeats itself. It only appears to do so to those who don't pay attention to the details. And I'm afraid we're not paying attention to the details here. I mean, this is not just an issue in the United States. It's look at the collapse of social democratic parties in Europe. I talk about this in the article, but how social democracy was the dominant form of government in Europe from the 70s to the 90s. I think there are social democrats now in the government of four of the 28 member nations of the European Union, places like Malta and Romania. So it's collapsing, and the parties of the center left and the center right are being destroyed. And it may be that you don't even agree with how people react to it, but it is a fact that these reactions are happening. One more thing about this claim that this is some kind of racist flashback. On our present course, the United States is projected to become majority non-Anglo. Add up the flows from Africa, Asia, Latin America, that the United States will become majority non-Anglo white by the year 2042. If you were to do what I recommend and cut the flow of legal immigration by half, do you know what would happen to that change? It would be bumped back by maybe 4 years. The decision, maybe 2046, maybe 2047, the decision about the ethnic future of the United States has already been made. And I begin with saying we are going to be a much more multi-ethnic country. How do we? That is not automatically going to be a success. That is a formula for difficulty. So how do we make a success of it? And that's going to mean, first, no more subordinated people. If you're inside the borders of the United States, you need to be on the path to citizenship. You need to be enrolled in the social insurance system. You need to be signed up for Medicare. Your wages need to be protected. And if we can't, but we can't do that for the planet. So that means there's got to be a limit on the number who come to the United States.
As promised, I want to add another voice, someone with a different perspective than David Frum, to this conversation. Jose Antonio Vargas is the founder of Define American, which promotes positive representation of immigrants in the media. His memoir is called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. It was published last year. Jose joins us from KUT in Austin. Jose, good to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me.
Your reaction to what you've heard so far from David Frum of The Atlantic?
So I've actually been reading David since I was, I think, in middle school, in high school. Arrived in this country. No. I mean, I didn't mean that as a disrespect. I mean that actually because, you know, he wrote a book called Dead Right. I think this was right after I was in middle school. I arrived there in 1993. And, you know, because since I was a kid, I have been confused by definitions of who's a liberal, who's a conservative, like, what does that mean, right? And so I've been following his work since then. And when this cover story was published, I tried reading it at least three times, because I take David as a serious thinker and as a serious man, and this is in the cover of The Atlantic. And then, you know, as I was scanning Twitter, as journalists are wont to do, I saw this tweet from Peter Brimlow. I think he's the editor of VDare, which is like a white nationalist site. And Peter tweeted, "There's nothing here that VDare.com," this is reacting to the cover story, "there's nothing here that VDare.com hasn't been saying for 20 years. Yet we're shadow banned, deplatformed, while Prum gets featured in The Atlantic." Go figure.
Jose Antonio Vargas, pause there for one moment.
Yes.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A. So VDare endorses, at least on social media, what they've read in Frum's articles.
What they've read in Frum's article. And then, you know, as a journalist, I went through, and actually I'd really love to ask David this question, you know, when you get a chance in this conversation. All of the stats that he mentioned about the economic contributions of immigrants, documented or undocumented, I was really curious where he got those facts from because they were not linked in the article. So, you know, I'll contact David directly and try to figure out where he directly got those stats. Because, you know, for example, I'm undocumented. This is tax season. I'm about to actually pay, I'm about to write a check to the Department of Treasury because undocumented workers pay billions of dollars in taxes and contribute billions of dollars more in Social Security. You know, David in the article makes the argument that this is a wash, that this doesn't really add up to anything positively. I don't know what to make of that given that, you know, I'm in Texas right now and there are entire industries in Texas. You know, I'm looking at the AmericanImmigrationCouncil.org, which I recommend people to look at. And when you look at the state of Texas, right, about what, 40% of the construction industry here in Texas rely on immigrant labor. 30% of the agriculture of accommodation and food services, agriculture, you know, administrative and support, waste management, 30%. So when you take immigrants out, documented or undocumented, what does that do to the economy? So, there, so that's the economic argument. But the bigger question, though, that I really want to grapple at, and Todd, I really applaud you for trying to make sure that we keep going back to this bigger question of who belongs in America. And I really want to talk to David about his thoughts about cutting legal immigration in half, right? Look, I am here in this country because of the family unification part of the immigration law that changed in 1965, right? Like, I'm one of 35 Filipino Americans here. I'm the only one out of 35 who was undocumented. Everybody else in my family is naturalized like David or born here. If you cut legal immigration in half, there are many immigrant families, right? Asian families, Latinx families, African Caribbean families, who would lose family members. I don't really know how to square the history of this country, which what, in the mid-1800s, we welcomed, what, 6 million Germans to this country until, like, the Ellis Island era. So what's the difference between Germans, Polish, Irish, and Italians moving here in the 18th and 19th century, many of whom, by the way, didn't speak English, right? I think at one point we had 6 German newspapers in this country, right? Versus people who are coming now.
Well, let's put that very question to David Frum before we have to take a break. And Lorraine Dowdy tweets along those lines. Trump is only concerned, and I don't mean to lump you in, David Frum, with Donald Trump in this sense, but Trump is only concerned about brown and black immigrants. Why no concern for all the Europeans, the Chinese and Russians, the Norwegians, the Irish who he wants in this country, who arrive by plane and overstay their visas? Illegal workers pay into Social Security and are not eligible for benefits.
All right, let me take a number of these points quickly. And first, let me deal with the point from Vidair and Peter Brimelow, who's a Canadian. I know him before he chose a dark path, unfortunately, and he did choose a dark path. During the campaign, I was approached by an acquaintance who worked on the Trump campaign and said, Donald, you've been talking about immigration this way since the 90s. And Donald Trump is now saying many of the things that you said. So why aren't you backing him? Because I did not. And I said, I said these things since the 1990s to stop Donald Trump, not to help him. I didn't know it was going to be Donald Trump. But this is the danger that I have been warning about, and now it's here. So I don't welcome this danger. I'm not going to enable this danger. I am aghast, more probably than even Jose. I am aghast by what is happening to the United States and to Britain and to Germany and to the European Union. But I saw it coming, and I've tried to do my part to prevent it. Now, on the economics and fiscal impact, this is a vexed subject. I've written about it a lot. But the whole point, the key concept is you have to count, when you're doing economics and fiscal study, you have to count both costs and benefits. You can't do single entry bookkeeping. Obviously, immigrants contribute in all kinds of ways to the health and size of the American economy. But they also have costs. And it is true that in print, you can't link all your sources the way you would with an online article. But for the major economic points, I did give my sources. So, for example, the best estimate, most recent comprehensive estimate we have of the total economic impact of immigration was presented in the Economic Report of the President in 2007 or 2000. I forget whether it was the 2006 or 2007 report. And they ran a big analysis, and they found that while immigration makes the total economy of the United States larger, obviously there are more human beings here, that if you look at its net impact on Americans, because most of the economic benefit of immigration is captured by the immigrants themselves, almost, in fact, almost all of it, it added up in an economy that was then $14 trillion a year, it added about $40 billion a year. That's not nothing, but it is fractions of a penny. Immigration makes the economy bigger, but it does not make Americans richer. And the fiscal impacts are even more complicated because while immigrants do pay taxes, they also do you services.
Ilya Machuda tweeted us, most people don't want to come to this country just because. No one flees where they're more comfortable culturally to trek it to America just to take advantage of the system. Sincerely, an immigrant from Nicaragua who crossed the border with her mother in 1989. My guests are Jose Antonio Vargas, journalist who came out as an undocumented immigrant after winning a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of Virginia Tech, and also David Frum of The Atlantic. More from both of these gentlemen here on 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stay close. It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're diving into the two questions at the heart of the debate around immigration. How many people America should let in and who those people should be. My guests are David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, and Jose Antonio Vargas, journalist and founder of Define American, which promotes positive representation of immigrants in the media. Jose Antonio, what about David Frum's, one of his warnings, one of his core economic and cultural arguments here, which is if you allow too many undocumented immigrants into the country, you create an underclass, not just people without access to benefits, but more and more people in communities who can't defend their own rights because they can't vote, they can't redress grievance, they can't serve on juries, and you're simply populating an underclass, and that's something to be avoided.
Again, I'm looking at this from the perspective of my own family, right? After Trump was elected president, I did my own census of my family. And I was stunned that out of the 14 people who were eligible to vote, only 3 voted. You know, these are Facebook friends. So they see all of my, please vote, please vote. I've been here for 25 years. I'm undocumented. I can't vote. So please vote. And then when I called around and I called my aunts specifically, one of my aunts said, you know, who's been here, you know, sent my cousins to school, right? Bought a house in Santa Clara. I've been paying her taxes, all of that. She said to me, Ton, that's my nickname in Tagalog. Ton, we're just here to work. They don't really want us here. Now, that's coming from someone who's a naturalized U.S. citizen, right? But because of what she consumes, what people tell her, including us in the news media, what people tell her immigrants are supposed to be, right? Or because of her own belief that, you know, again, she's just here as labor, right? She doesn't feel like she's a part of America. And she's naturalized, right? This is where I think we have to talk about the fact that in this country, you know, we have, according to the Pew Research Center, we have about 43 to 45 million immigrants in this country, which will who together will constitute 88% of the total U.S. population growth in the next 50 years. So this idea of social cohesion, right, like how we welcome people in this country, who belongs in this country, I think is a real fundamental question. As I was reading David's article, I kept trying to look for that. And, you know, I have to really say, and this is a question to David, you know, I was rather confused and, you know, frustrated that it seems to be that in the article, you know, you're blaming immigrants for the rise of Brexit and fascism, but seems not to be holding politicians responsible for any of this behavior. Why is that?
Let's let David answer.
Because the article is written without the language of blame. One of the things, I don't blame in this article.
Wait a second.
I'm sorry. I invite people to read it. The whole point of the article is not to blame anybody for anything. Everybody is making decisions that, from their individual point of view, make sense. I understand why people migrate. I understand why people migrate illegally. It's also a fact that people are going to react to that. I do try to write this in a kind of neutral way as a system. I think I say quite explicitly in the article, again and again, that the even illegal border crossers and even the Central American asylum seekers who are gaming the system, they are doing what we would do probably in their place. But there's something also that needs to be said as we look to the future. And I want to pick up on the woman who sent that email or Twitter tweet who was from Nicaragua. I think a lot of Americans have a view that what is going on outside the United States is a world of poverty and horror and desperation and people leave. The reason why immigration flows are accelerating in our modern world. Between 1990 and 2015, in that quarter of a century, 45 million people moved from the global south to the global north, not just the United States. Australia is by courtesy in the global north, even though it's in the literal south. Why? Why has that movement picked up? And it's the answer is because the world's getting richer. People who are desperate can't move, or they cannot move very far. It takes resources. To come here from Nicaragua costs probably $5,000 or $8,000. It costs even more to come from China. And that's if you come illegally. And legal movement is also expensive. But we have seen this extraordinary reduction in global poverty and the rise of a new global striver class. Poverty is living on less than $2 a day. We've got a class of people, hundreds of millions, maybe billions of people, who have incomes of $10 or $15 a day. Now, that makes them not well off by North American or European standards, but makes them quite well off by the standards of where they come. They can buy air conditioners, they can buy smartphones, and the thing that they want to buy for not all of their family members, but for some of their sons, is access to the developed world. And so these migration flows are going to accelerate in the 21st century. So you can't think about just what is your policy for today, but how are you going to cope with a planet in which there are hundreds of millions of people who are going to be on the move?
Jose Antonio?
So that to me is actually the question, right? This actually, when I ended up writing my book, I dedicated it partly to, there's 258 million migrants in the world. That is the largest movement of people the world has ever seen. And how these receiving countries choose to welcome, right, and decide who belongs is, to me, probably the defining question of the 21st century. Let me just say, though, that what's missing in this conversation, you know, as I'm listening to David, what's missing here are actually trying to understand the root causes of migration, why people have to move in the first place. What role does colonialism and imperialism, what role does globalization, what role, you know, when David said a few minutes ago that, you know, Americans are not getting richer because of immigration, well, corporations are getting richer. Certainly, right? I mean, as I'm sitting here, I'm staring at my iPhone that can be manufactured in China, delivered to Cupertino near where I grew up, and then end up in New York where I buy it. We're living at a time in which products, goods, companies have more right to migrate than human beings do. What is that about, right? How do we talk about that? And, you know, David,
I am talking about it, and what I'm saying, it's not 250. There, as I said, from the global south in the quarter century is 45 million people, but there will be more. What I'm saying is the migrants have a point of view. So do the receiving countries. And the receiving countries are not just bound to say welcome to everybody who wants to come. They are also, they have citizens and they have national interests. And by the way, we, you and I, as people who have moved to this country and migrated to this country and have settled here and made our lives here, we owe our first duty of loyalty to the people among whom we moved. And they should be our first concern.
Now, Chaz East from Michigan emails a point along the lines that I think you would agree with, Jose Antonio. Will the United States ever take responsibility for the imperialism which destabilized Latin America in the first place and causes illegal immigration today? A point that you raised, Jose Antonio. I want to move us to another critical issue, however, how to solve this problem. And this problem, for good or for ill, if it's ever solved, is going to be solved by our politicians with hopefully the urgings of an electorate that's engaged. There is an election afoot already, if you can believe it. And Democratic candidates have been out on the trail talking about this issue. Donald Trump is talking about it as well. I played him at the top saying the country is full. Here is Beto O'Rourke. Here's Senator Kamala Harris of California and Julian Castro of Texas.
And the militarization of our border not only costs us $19.5 billion a year, that's what you're paying right now, but it also costs us our conscience.
When we talk about the immigration debate, I think there is no question that there are powerful forces, including this president, that are attempting to vilify immigrants because they were born in another country and suggest that they are therefore any different in terms of their fundamental values or beliefs or priorities. And I think all of us as Americans should be insulted by that suggestion.
What I share with the president is that I believe in a border that is secure. I believe that our border is more secure than it's ever been. But whereas he wants you to choose cruelty, I want you to choose compassion.
I want to hear from each of you on how you think the political system is responding to the issues that we're talking about here today. Jose Antonio, you go first.
I would really implore people. I think Julian Castro has been the first Democratic candidate that has actually put forth an immigration policy and some proposals. I've been reviewing it and listening to some of his interviews. I really challenge all the presidential candidates on the Democratic side to do the same. I think President Trump is making himself very, very clear as to where he stands on these policies. And I think, for example, as I said, I'm in Texas, right? In the state of Texas, there's about, 1.8 million undocumented Texans. I think it's more than that if you count undocumented Asian, which does not become a part of the conversation, undocumented African, you know, undocumented white immigrants. In the state of Texas, undocumented people cannot drive, right? Like, do they think undocumented immigrants in states across the country should be allowed to actually apply for driver's licenses. To me, that's a key issue at a time in which there's no solution and immigration reform is unlikely.
Now, we heard from three Democratic candidates vying for the Democratic base, to be fair. David Frum, you have said that the radicalization of Donald Trump and the right has counter-radicalized liberals. Is that what you're hearing there?
That's what I'm hearing. Julian Castro, for example, who's got, as Jose Antonio says, as the most comprehensive. His view is basically no one should be removed from the country if they're, no matter how illegally present they are, no matter how recently they cross the border, unless they've committed some other crime as well. And that is pushing Democrats to a place where no Democratic candidates have ever been, and where Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and Bernie Sanders are all horrified by where their party is ending up. And it's a reaction to Donald Trump. It's emotional. You hear the tone of their voices. Here's what, in my opinion, what we should do, and we need to think of this as a system. First, reduce the legal flow to numbers that free up the bureaucracy so that it can cope. And my nomination is to go back to the pre-1990 level of about 550,000 a year. At the border, we need a crash program, a faster judicial hearings, so that people get the asylum claims are heard fast and rejected fast, because the Central American claims are an abuse of the asylum system, which is here to protect people from state-sponsored persecution. We need workplace enforcement. Demilitarize the border. Beto O'Rourke is right about that. The border is a bad place to do enforcement. But meaningful enforcement at the workplace. Take away the incentives from employers to enforce illegally. And we need a question of making sure that people who fly into the country, almost half the illegal immigrants now arrive by plane, not by foot, make sure they leave. And then we need, with the population of illegal immigrants, to move the long-settled illegal immigrants, the majority of the 11 million people, rapidly to citizenship and to enrollment in the social insurance system, to make Americans of them.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A. Jose Antonio, in the few minutes we have left, I'm not sure how much you and David Frum would agree on the policy prescriptions that he just laid out. Decrease the flow to 550,000, faster hearings, beef up judges, workplace enforcement in favor of militarizing the border. Maybe you'd agree on some of those. But I played those clips from the Democratic candidates, and I played Donald Trump, which everybody's heard, for a reason, which is the question of whether this political environment, this campaign, the polarized radicalization and counter-radicalization that David Frum complains about, is capable of actualizing this great conversation that we three and our listeners are having today. Is it?
I think we're living at a time in which every community, right? Every community, every county, every town, every state has to really decide at a moment like this how they welcome people and what policies they support. I'm privileged enough to come from California, right, which has been billed as a sanctuary state. And that's not because California is some left liberal, whatever people call it. That's because in the state of California, undocumented immigrants are completely integrated into people's lives. They're the neighbors, they're classmates, they're friends, they go to the same church, they open businesses, right? People actually know us. And I have to say, in the few minutes we have left in this conversation, when you first invited me to come to the show, I wasn't quite sure whether or not I should accept it. I'm glad I did, and I'm privileged to have accepted it.
Me too.
I should say, by the way, that's, you know, since David talks about the humanity of immigrants, and I salute him for that. You know, people like me are here illegally, right? So there's no question about that. I am here without authorization from the government. I can get detained and deported at any point. But I, as a person, am not illegal, because people can't be illegal, right? And I hope that as David continues to talk about this, he's referred to people as illegal immigrants several times in this conversation. I know that NPR still does it, the New York Times, the Washington Post, of which I come from, by the way. Language here is so important, right? Who defines the language defines the conversation. And for far too long, I actually think people like David, of all backgrounds, have defined this conversation for so many immigrants. And, you know, I got to tell you, David, when I was reading that article, and I applaud you for saying that you wrote it without wanting to blame anybody. I feel like you blamed me. I feel like you blamed all those other immigrants, right? And you said, instead of, again, questioning these regimes, these fascist regimes, you're putting all the onus on the immigrants, who don't have the power not only to define, right, but to actually go up against all these facts.
David?
Well, I think if you're going to take part in an enormously important public conversation, you have to be able to read things that you don't agree with without getting bruised.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that's part of being an adult. And if you can't do that, you can't participate in an adult conversation at all. You know, we have a lot at stake here, not just the present, but the future. One of the things people say in adventure movies is failure is not an option. But in democracy, failure is always an option. There is no guarantee that the American experiment is going to succeed. To make a success of it, we need to have a strong economy. We need to have a strong fiscal system, but we have to need a strong sense of cohesion. And this is one of the points I make in the article. I really want even people who are inclined to disagree with me to think about this. Without enforcement, there are no borders. Without borders, there are no nations. Without nations, when somebody said borders are just lines on the map, of course that's true. But inside those borders are electorates. Because without borders, there are no electorates. And without electorates, there's no democracy. Democracy has grown up with the idea of strong states with strong borders. In the days when there were no borders, we didn't have democratic systems. We just had principalities everywhere. You're going to have democracy, you need borders. And what we are putting at risk with a system in which it says people can come and go is, when do people become voters? Who is not a voter? To whom does the state have obligations?
I want to give the last word this hour to listener Alex Gomez, who reached out on Twitter. You mentioned that immigrants are the same as everyone else. I feel like the current administration's immigration policies are phrased and reported on in a way that separates immigrants from being human, allowing for different public reactions. David Frum is a senior editor at The Atlantic. His article is titled, "If Liberals Won't Enforce Borders, Fascists Will." It was recently on the cover of the magazine. David, thank you for being here in the studio.
Thank you so much.
From KUT in Austin, Texas, Jose Antonio Vargas, the founder of Define American and author of Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. As always, Jose Antonio, great to speak with you, and I'm glad you decided to join us.
Thanks for having me.
Today's show was produced by Avery Kleinman. To learn more about her and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Joshua will be back tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup, but until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for being here. This is 1A.